Hello, everybody. Before we get started, I wanted to make sure you went to savageclassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. I'm going to go there right now. How about that? Savageclassical.com. You hit it, and let's see what we got here. All right, the first thing to come up is a Robert Vincent spruce in East Indian rosewood. I'm going to read more about it. It looks like it's been discounted. Roughly $1,500 down to $6,000. No, I'm sorry, not one and a half. I'm bad at math. That's going to be about $500 off right now. There's only one in stock. It's got this interesting thing. Let's check this out. You can zoom in on the pictures. I'm zooming in right now on a picture of a sound port with a cork next to it. Now, I don't know. I've never had a sound port guitar, but I don't think they all come like that. So it looks like it's got like a cork sort of thing that you can put into the sound hole, maybe get some more, so you can enjoy the sound port when you're practicing. What a sound port is, for people that don't know what I'm talking about, it's a little hole on these new, probably modern guitars that are built over the last 30 years. Some of them have these little ports in them, where it's on the side of the guitar, so you have a sound hole that's facing you. It's almost like a, you know, if you've ever played on a rock stage, it's like having a monitor in front of you. So it makes it where you can hear your own guitar better, which is great because it can be very offsetting to not be able to hear yourself on stage because all the sound is just being bled out into the audience. But, you know, if you are comfortable with that, which I am, you can put that thing in there and it looks like you can get some more, oomph in your boomph. That's the way I'm going to put that. All right, so it was pretty easy to get out of that. Let's go ahead and let's see what else he's got going on. Browse. Let's browse on sale. Because I'm cheap. What's on sale? You got anything on sale? Okay. Okay. Oh, well, all right. I don't want to look at the sale. Come on. Give me this stuff. I'm just having some fun here. Let's go. Let's check out the real stuff. Classical guitars. Oh, look at this. Matt Rendell Classical Guitar 2015 Modern Romantic Spruce Maple. Dude, I can't believe I haven't visited this guy. That's just, I'm like afraid. Because when I go into a guitar shop, what happens is I want to buy it. I get it in my head. I get that itch. And then I spend like a month shopping for guitars only to, you know, freak out. I just don't have any money. Oh, that's really interesting. So the top has like this little hole cut into the head. And then at the back is like this white sort of, what is that? Flame, it says right here. It's easy on the site to see, sort of see what everything is. You can zoom in. It's a real nice site, which is huge. You know, a lot of these people, it's like you go to their sites, it's something, it's like Windows 95. I'm like, you really want me to buy a guitar from you if you're, you know. Why don't you take 1,000 of the 5,000 that I just gave you for this? Fuck that. The 20,000 that I just gave you and put it towards, you know, maybe getting some real web design. Anyway, go to savageclassical.com, which has a great website. It just seems like hundreds of guitars for you to see. And you can go visit him in Bayshore, New York. Make sure and tell him Big Diaper Brett sent you. Let's get on with the show. Welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. On the show today, we have Guyan Riley. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm going to find out here pretty soon. It's my birthday. I'm fielding some birthday texts. Hey, Book. Oh, Boog. By the way, if you don't know, I'm going to tell you right now, my nickname at home is Boogie. The Boogeyman is what they called me when I was a kid. My little brother just calls me Boog Boog. My late grandmother used to call me Boogers. So I have that if you want to know, if you were ever curious about it, that's what's going on. So I'm getting a lot of Boog Boog Boogers. I like it when my brother calls me Boog Boog because he says Boog Boog. Oh, there it is. See, now you guys can probably hear that. I got to turn that off. Let me turn the Wi-Fi off. Let's see. Can me and Molly come over earlier to give you a birthday present? You know what? No, you can't. You know, I said 8 o'clock, people. I've had like three people like, hey, I got a concert tonight. Is it okay if I come over a little earlier? No. It's not. It's my birthday. I said 8 o'clock. You make it happen. You be there when I told you to be there. All right, Rory, my little brother. Everybody's like, well, you know, I'm getting out of work. And then what am I going to do for 2 hours? I don't know. Eat. You ever thought about eating? Everybody here is a fucking alcoholic. I swear to God. You don't know what life is like in New York. It's like if you don't drink, it's over. I don't know. I just pressed the wrong button. I hope I didn't because I'm loving this rant. You know, I didn't drink all week. And, you know, because I knew that tonight was going to be a bender. And, you know what's hard about not drinking? Is it real? I don't understand how you people socialize. How do you do it? How do you socialize when you're not drinking? What do you do? Do you join like you play basketball with each other and then you go out and don't talk to each other afterwards? It's simply the nucleus of every social situation I've ever been a part of. And everybody who doesn't drink or who drinks a little or who takes it easy is in bed early and isn't really that much fun to talk to. So I just don't get what you guys are doing. And I'm not pushing for people to drink more. I guess coffee. But then coffee, you have those spastic conversations and I don't know. Coffee's different. And coffee, you can't keep drinking it. You know, you can only have, at least I can't. I can only have one or two. My friend Tony Landman, who has been on the show, put it perfectly once when I was in college. And I said to him, I said, hey, I have been, I forget exactly what the case was because I was in college forever ago. I'm turning 39 today, folks. And we'll get back to that. But anyway, so I said to Tony, I said, I don't know if we talked about this in the episode, but he didn't drink at that point. Now he doesn't really either. A little bit, maybe. Nothing. When he drinks, it's what I would consider not drinking. So, you know, if I have like two or three beers, that's not drinking. That's a night off. But he asked me, he goes, hey, you okay? Because we were studying for a test or something. And I go, yeah, I'm just really hungover. He goes, oh, man, were you out late? And I was like, yeah, I drink like 10 beers or something. And he goes, you know, I couldn't drink 10 glasses of water. How do you do that? And I didn't know what to say. So I think I just said something like, maybe the bubbles. I don't know. But it is amazing how much alcohol a seasoned adult can ingest. I mean, I'm just an old pro, and I'm a great drunk. And I'm talking about this because tonight's going to be my big night. And you know, if you have a problem with drinking, I understand. Look, I've got a problem with other people drinking, but I just happen to be, I think, a good drunk. And maybe I get a little irritating sometimes to some people, but I don't think I would get, if you like the way I am now on the show, I think you're going to love me when I'm drunk. because I don't know. It's just, I do well. People get drunk with me and then they kind of are like, I want to go get drunk with you again. And it becomes sort of a problem where I'm expected to go to birthday parties and bat mitzvahs and all sorts of things, and sort of entertain people like a clown. And instead of paying me my regular clown rate, I get to give you $150 or a multiple of 8 or 48? Is it 48? What's the thing for the bat mitzvahs? It's supposed to be, the gifts are supposed to be a multiple of a 48. I don't know. I act like I go to them all the time. I've only been to one. I'm going to another one in April. And I'm excited. I love that tradition. I'm not Jewish, but I love that tradition. The idea of saying goodbye to a kid right before they become an asshole. It's great. It's great because that's the last time they're going to talk to you is when they're 12. And after that, it's just like you are you're on the outside looking in. Generally speaking, there are those wonderful cases of parents and kids getting along all the way through. But for me, it was just check out. I don't think I went on a vacation after I was 13 with my family. They would go to cool places too. They were like, we're going to Boston. We're going to Hawaii. And I think the last one I did was when I was either maybe 12, maybe 13. And it was, we went to Washington, D.C. That was the last family vacation I get. Here's a text from my mom today. I have a method to the colors I picked. I picked all dark so you could wash them all together in one load and save money. All right, this is really, really fucking funny. All right, my mom just texted me. This is what happened. And my mom may listen to this. I don't think she listens to the show anymore. This is like episode 71 now. She... I'm glad she sent this text. All right. My mom sent brown towels for my birthday, like two brown towels, one for me, one for Wendy. But if Wendy and I break up, I'm taking both. Actually, I'm returning them to Amazon. Don't tell my mom. All right. So it says, she says today at 10 o'clock a.m., she says, "Happy birthday, Boogie. I posted it on Facebook too. Rory has a present for you tonight. I love you so much." And then she wrote the word R, O-U-R. I don't know. She just, you know what she does? She voice activates the text. And she doesn't have an iPhone, so you get what you get. And I said, I said, "Oh, mommy, but I got the brown towels you sent," you know, kind of making fun of her, like, well, I got the brown towels. I didn't know I was going to get anything else. I got to admit, I was a little let down. Okay? You open it up, I'm thinking, like, what is this? This could be anything. This could be an Xbox One Elite controller. This could be a wireless Bluetooth headset for the gym. This could be a year membership to City Bike. This could be a lot of cool things for under $200. Not that my parents have spent that much on me in a while, but they would if I asked for it. They give me anything I want, right? I'm just saying that because they might be listening. That's not true. They're wonderful parents in every way. And then she says, "What? I ordered you a navy blue one and Wendy a purple. I demand a refund. Remember, at 2:59 this afternoon, you will be 39. So at 2:59 on February 5th, I will be 39. That's when I'm doing the interview. That's when I'm doing this thing. You guys will get it a week in the future. I can't add 7 to 5 right now, but it's whatever that is. That'll be the release date. I already traded them in for yellow and red," I said to her. "But between you and me, I actually just called Amazon and I said, I got two brown towels in the mail. Is there any way I can get whatever that's worth and just put it on my account?" And they said, "Sure." I mean, can you guys believe Amazon exists? Is this not the most amazing time to be a consumer? I'm sorry. I want to go to the store down the street and buy something and not be able to return it and be charged full retail price for it just like the next guy. You know, and do the right thing and keep American businesses alive. But dude, can you imagine the shit I would get if someone bought me a towel from, you know, I don't know, Herb and Margot's towel market down the street, and then I tried to return it? Can you imagine the hoops I'd have to jump through? I just call these guys. I'm like, "Yeah, I got two brown towels. I have no use for brown towels. My bathroom is a lot of fun. My bathroom has a lot of colorful stuff in it. So it's got like colors and kids stuff and stickers and just shit everywhere. It's like the Love Shack from the B-52s video. That's the way I like a bathroom. I'm going to put a disco ball in my bathroom. Don't steal that idea from me. And also don't steal the idea of calling your kid Oat from me. And Mark Maron, who has the best podcast in the world, I originally, and I have friends that can attest to this, for years, I said I was going to get a dog and call him Monkey. Mark Maron has a cat named Monkey, so that's no longer a big deal. But back then, people thought that was the best thing. When you're 21 and you say something like that, that's the funniest thing anybody's ever heard. I said, "I already traded them in for a yellow and a red." I don't know why I made up those colors. Now that I think about it, isn't that like mustard hot dogs and McDonald's? And then I said, "I'm just teasing you. They are good towels. I love you, Mimi." That's her nickname. And then she writes, "Just now, as I'm recording this, I have a method to the colors I picked, ! I picked all dark so you could wash them all together in one load and save money." You know, she's where I get the jokes from. It's that side. My dad's very funny. He's not very funny. What am I? Come on. I mean, he's it's superb intellectual. He has a great gift for retaining you know, information, important and otherwise. And he is an eloquent speaker and writer. As is my mother, but all the funny stuff is kind of from my mom. The timing, all, you know, the complaining, that's all her. That's what we would do. That's what we do when we're having a moment together, is we are complaining about people or making fun of them. And it's a magical relationship for, you know, there's nothing funnier than a funny mom. I don't know. That's not true. The funniest guy I ever knew was Wendy's dad. And he was hilarious in every possible way. He used to sing to his dogs, and he was great. I miss that guy. Anyway, so that's my birthday. And basically, you know, when I say come at 8 o'clock, let's get back to the whole drinking thing. You know, I didn't drink this week. And when I say that, I don't mean like, oh, I had 3 beers a night, like I was suggesting. I mean, I didn't touch the sauce. And in preparation for this night, I wanted it to be a good night. I didn't want anybody. I don't fight when I drink. You know, I don't. If anything, I may get a little bit tired after a couple of them. But you know, I have methods of solving that problem. So I can do it. But other people I know, and I'm not going to name names, who want to come early, can't do it that well. They drink, they get a little bit. People get blackout drunk. I never got that. I got it once in college, and I danced on a Mercedes-Benz and peed in a corner and ate 6 slices of pizza. That's what happened to me when I blacked out. And I smoked cigarettes, and I was trying to quit smoking. That was like the entire... That was my blackout experience in college. All right, that's not that bad. Dancing on a Mercedes-Benz, pretty bad. But I was a class warrior back then. I don't know. Well, you know what we drank? We drank purple margaritas, whatever flavor that is. That could be anything. So, you know, it has that. It goes down smooth, and then it comes up very acidic. What is it? What's the purple icy drink? I know it had tequila in it. It was a mess. And the problem is that, you know, I know that some of you who don't drink, you know, you guys really think this is, everybody's just like, well, just don't drink. I don't know, man. I don't know. It is such a big part of what I do and what me and my friends do. I think it's keeping us young. I think it's keeping our eyes open. I think it's keeping us out a little bit later. And it's making it so that, it's a very inexpensive way to enjoy yourself. I go to a vacation in my mind. Anyway, I don't know why I'm continuing to talk about this. I think that was an excellent intro. We have, I'm going to go ahead and call him Gian Riley for now. Then we're going to find out how to pronounce his name. And, then we're going to move on with the interview. But, I think I said that the show is sponsored by Savage Classical. If I didn't, let me say it again. It's sponsored by Savage Classical. You can go to savageclassical.com and get the guitar of your dreams from Richard Sage right there in Bayshore, New York. Get that guitar. Tell him I sent you. Don't go today. It's kind of snowy out today. Actually, it's a beautiful, beautiful light snow. Nothing like the violent thunderstorm that we had last week, was it? It's great. Great little snow. Gian Riley is, of course, he's the son of Terry Riley. Now, I don't know how to bring this up. I've never had the son or the daughter of a legendary musician before who's making his own way. And whose music, Gian's music, or Gian's music, it's great. It's unbelievable. It's really, really, really special music. And his dad, I had forgotten how much I loved and how influential his music was on me. It was just a breath of fresh air in an otherwise atonal desert that was, learning about modern music in the academic setting. So, if you haven't listened to Terry Riley's music, definitely go get it. The piece in C is a large scale, a piece for multiple instruments that you can get started with if you want to look into it. It's a great, great gateway drug for people looking to get into new tonal music. And as is Guyan's, Riley's music as well. He plays electric guitar. He plays steel string guitar in some pieces. His new album is new-ish. What happened? You mean I timed out? What do you mean I timed? I've never been timed out of this. Come on. No internet connection. Well, anyway, I don't have an internet connection. I'm not about to connect it. You know, anyway, just go ahead and look up Guyan's music for yourself. But he is a brilliant young composer and musician and a great guitarist. So no one could be better for this show. I'm really looking forward to the interview. So I'm going to let you guys go. Remember to go to audibletrial.com/insider. That's audibletrial.com/insider. Don't go to audible.com. That's a porn site. audibletrial.com/insider. You go there and you download the audiobook download of your choice. All right, now we're going to have some more sponsors next time that are kind of doing the same deal. The way that Audible Trial works is that I get a cut of whatever you buy. And it's a pretty substantial cut. So make sure you go over there, support the show, and try out Audible. If you haven't listened to a book, I just did it. You know what? I got to be honest. I haven't done it. Because I read. And I think you guys, I talked about it before. I sort of act out the stuff. It's like a creative sort of a little fun thing that I do at night when I'm by myself. I don't act it out. I just sort of, you know, say the things. I use accents. And I am, yeah, I have issues. I have to constantly be engaged in something or I fall into a void of darkness. All right. So that's what explains the podcast, the compositions, and the fact that I'm not at audibletrial.com/insider downloading a free audiobook download of my choice or getting a 30-day free trial. The reason that I'm not doing that is because I have deep emotional and psychological issues that I don't have the resources to deal with, nor the time, nor the inclination. So I'm just going to go ahead and act out my books to myself like a crazy person at night. Wendy has come out at night and seen me doing it and asked who I was talking to. And I acted like she was infringing on me being an artist. I guess that's an example of what happens when you aren't as good at drinking as you think that you are. You do things like that. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Here is Mr. Riley.
Okay, so your name is Guyan.
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 Yeah.
Guyan. Guyan.
Guyan.
Does that mean anything?
It means knowledge.
It does?
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Is that some sort of like Tibetan thing or something? Sounds like
knowledge is everywhere.
Is knowledge some sort of new age Tibetan thing?
I have an Indian name. So.
Oh, it's Indian?
Yeah.
Like American, Native American?
No, like.
Oh,
like
Indian. That's what I would think. India. That's kind of where I was going. I was going to go to the mountains and come down.
Yeah. You're close with Tibet.
It's close enough. But it's definitely Indian.
It's an Indian name. Yeah.
Knowledge, that's a good name. And then, so you said we were just talking and we're both from California, but you're from the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Yeah.
Out there, you said highway, not highway 4.
49.
49. What's the difference? How far away is 49? Is that more like Yosemite stuff?
Well, 49 is a long highway running in California through all of the, it's sort of the gold country route. So stemming from, I think, Angel's Camp or Murphy's might be one of the last towns on the southern end, and then going all the way up north through Nevada City, where I'm from,
and
then it keeps going up.
Right,
it does this.
So there's 90, there's 99 or 90 or whatever, and then I'm assuming that this is the next one that goes north and south for a long time.
Yeah, it's the really curvy one.
Yeah, I don't like that one.
Yeah,
it's too scary.
It's really fun to drive if you've done it a lot of times. Yeah.
What was it like growing up in the foothills? I've always loved the foothills. Aside from, you know, it gets a little bit of a name because of the drugs, because of the meth.
Yeah.
Just around, you know, if you tell somebody, just, you know, they'll be like, oh, you know. But the thing is, it's a very, I thought it was a very spiritual and fun place to live.
Yeah.
I have my best friend in California, Omar, lives in the foothills now. He just moved back there after living in the Bay Area forever, and he's back. Right. I was there for Christmas. I make sure I get up there every time.
Well, the spiritual part of it stems from the weed that it's known for, not the meth.
That's right. Everybody's smoking some weed.
Yeah, there's a pretty serious dichotomy between the meth people and the weed people there. So,
but it was fun growing up there.
Because I grew up with the weed people and not the meth people.
You grew up with the weed people.
Yeah, well, it's a big cash crop in California in general.
Aside from the obvious, musical upbringings. What did you and your friends listen to there? Were you listening to a lot of, Dead and stuff like that? How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 38.
Okay, I'm 39.
Okay.
Okay, great. So we're the same age, so it's around the same time.
Yeah.
So Grateful Dead would have been still alive.
Yeah.
And was that a thing for you?
I wasn't part of the Dead scene at all. I was listening to, all kinds of things from, 80s pop, really kind of crazy, that girl, awesome girl pop, like Debbie Gibson and Tiffany and all that stuff. When I was in third and fourth grade, that was Lionel Richie, Billy Ocean, all that stuff. That was when I
soulful,
my taste started going and
singing.
Yeah. Right. And then went quickly to,
metal.
Yeah. Went through Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses to, onto getting really seriously into punk rock, starting with Dead Kennedys and the Misfits and the Dead Milkmen, and I just got heavily immersed in all that stuff.
Did you like the Misfits? Did you like Glenn Danzig's albums, his solo albums?
Totally, yeah.
I do too.
Big fan of those.
Those really, really hold up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can still listen to them, they're still good.
And they're back in that time. The thing about those Danzig albums that I like is the it still kind of has that hair metal attention to quality, like studio quality, like studio value.
Definitely.
That was sort of during the grunge era, they played it down. It was all about vintage equipment and vintage boards and all that stuff. So that was sort of the end where you get that giant, big digital.
Right. As opposed to the early Misfits albums that have a certain
total.
That don't have that finesse, but they have that incredible, unnameable sound to them.
Yeah. It's thick.
Yeah.
It's thick. It's way thicker than all the other stuff.
Yeah.
I like Misfits.
Yeah,
I like that whole thing, but and what about what was the other? So you were doing that? Did you do Bauhaus? Listen to that?
No,
I'm just thinking about stuff I listened to in the foothills.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually
people
funny.
People are smart up there, man. They have all this time on their hands, and they create things to do that people in Stockton didn't really do. We just kind of because there was enough. There were enough Lions restaurants to go waste our time in.
Right.
To where we didn't have to build a, make a kite.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. Yeah, well, where I grew up was pretty far from any sort of, how should I say, city run recreational programs or anything like that. It was just we were out in the sticks, so if we wanted to not go crazy, we had to make our own activities.
Make your own fun.
I started but that's how I came to guitars actually through, when I first started playing guitar, that's kind of how I learned as initially was listening to, those kind of early punk records and for me it was early punk and trying to figure out what they were doing on guitar. And
you're
I had
talking
no,
about early
no idea.
Punk.
Well, I mean like
you're not
my,
talking about
my early experience with punk, trying to figure out what exactly they were doing and how to play those riffs on guitar. And
you're saying what exactly? So you were trying to mimic it. You weren't just playing the power chords that they were playing.
Well, I mean, I was also doing that, but I didn't quite understand it because I was on a crappy little nylon string guitar and I couldn't get the same sound. I was like, how do they do that?
Well, they have an electric guitar.
Yeah, I know. So I figured that out eventually, but it was great because there were a lot of things a lot of the Dead Milkmen songs were clean tone guitar, and I could figure out those chords, and they were kind of interesting guitar parts, that was kind of an early teacher for me, is just through press and rewind and play over and over and over and over and over, figuring out it's kind of relatively simple kind of folk guitar punk riffs and everything.
Oh, yeah. For sure. No, well that's an interesting actual. I don't know if there's that many. And then classical guitar, did you study it? Did you take lessons? I mean, I don't know if there's going to be anybody up there to really take lessons.
Yeah, no, I had a great teacher. I had a great teacher named Brent Weaver, who was my teacher for 3 years.
Okay.
So right around...
And he was a classical teacher?
He was a classical teacher. Oh, cool. He was a classical teacher. I started...
I shouldn't say that. Yeah, there's a lot of people everywhere. You know,
they're all over the
place.
They're
all over the place. Yeah. Yeah.
There were three guys in my hometown. Three, mm-hmm. Basically three guys and, you know...
Three highly skilled classical guitar teachers.
Yeah. They were all, you know, they all had their own little body of students and everything.
Do you
and
talk to Brent Weaver?
I have lost touch with him. I don't know where he is. Maybe he's going to hear this program and he'll, you know.
He'll come on.
Yeah, he'll come on. Come
he
on
totally
the show.
Totally should, Brent.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I'll go to the Foothills and do some interviews. Get those guys going on. The Definitely. Weed guys, not the meth guys.
Not the meth guys.
They talk too fast. Yeah. Give me a headache. Yeah. But as far as like going on from there, what did you do? Where did you go to school then? I don't know if I read anything about that. I kind of just focused on listening.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's cool. No, I moved to San Francisco when I was 18 and went to the San Francisco Conservatory of Music.
Who were you with there?
I was first with David Tannenbaum for 4 years, and then I did grad studies with Dusan Bogdanovic.
Well, I mean, those are two wildly different people.
Yeah.
Even though they're both, I don't know if David Tannenbaum would be a new music guy, but he did I guess he had that Brower album. I always remember.
Oh,
that.
Because
that came out when we were starting out, probably.
Right?
Yeah,
sure. No, David is primarily a new music guy. Actually.
I think
that's
so.
His field of expertise.
And then Dusan is a composer.
Yeah.
And so, did you know Dusan growing up, or did that like was that relationship there from the beginning?
I discovered him when I, through discovering David and wanting to eventually go to the conservatory, I heard about Dusan and then I got some of his albums and was immediately, you know, completely mind blown by what I was hearing.
Now, this is the real interesting thing, obviously, about you, is that I think that people would maybe assume that you wouldn't play guitar, given, you know, the heritage. I don't know what your dad plays, but I'm assuming he plays piano.
He's a pianist.
Yeah. So did he try and push piano on you, or did you just... So he was just like, do what you want, buddy.
Yeah.
And you did guitar.
Yeah.
And what drew you... I mean, I guess what drew you to the guitar was the Dead Kennedys, the Misfits.
Yeah.
That was the only way you could play. You can't play that with a piano or a saxophone.
You could play anything on anything. It just doesn't quite sound the same.
That's right.
But the real stroke of luck was that I won a guitar in a raffle when I was 12. And
it was a classical guitar?
And it was a classical guitar.
What kind of guitar was it?
Oh,
I don't like asking that question.
No, it wasn't. You know, I don't even remember the brand name. It was like worth about $40, I think. So it wasn't something that you would recognize.
But it was something you won.
It was something that I won, and it also
you earned by winning.
by putting my name on a little piece of paper in a hat. But I also won four lessons.
I won my Super Bowl pool last night.
Oh, good.
I did. I won
congratulations.
$60. Thanks very much.
All right. Drinks on you after this.
That's right. Oh, well, you can go ahead and you can have whatever you want out of there.
Oh, nice.
I can't really drink because I'm going to teach. You know what? Maybe I can.
You probably can. Yeah.
That's good. That's, you know, have you ever had that? Look, that's Rogue. You know Rogue beer?
Yeah.
That's whiskey by them.
Oh, I know the Dead Guy Ale, and that's the...
You got to try it. Yeah, I'll give you a little sip before you leave.
All right.
It tastes perfect. You like bourbon a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay. So it tastes like baby bourbon. You know, maybe that Hudson Valley, you know, that little
cute little bottles,
ridiculously expensive half bottle.
Yeah.
All those things, all those things taste like that, where they have that sort of like licorice sort of flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not bourbon to me, really.
Hmm.
But I think all bourbon that's not from Kentucky seems to have that flavor. That's my opinion.
I'm not an expert enough on it to know, but I enjoy it. So
you're about to be. And these teachers are going to get taught by somebody who's very drunk. Anyway, so as far as you know, going on to Dusan and stuff like that, and being in San Francisco, being from Stockton and you being from there, man, going to San Francisco at that age is just so exciting, right? It's the best.
Yeah,
it's the biggest city in the world.
Well, if you grow up in a small foothills town, it feels enormous,
it feels limitless.
Even though it's only 7 miles across, it seems like an entire universe.
It's about the size of Austin.
Yeah, it's tiny, but
they have a really good. They do a very good job. I think it's the hills too, because it gives you that sense of like there's something over there.
Yeah,
it's probably more city. it's just ocean, or it's in the Embarcadero or whatever. Not the Embarcadero. Is that the one with the military? base was.
Presidio?
Presidio. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
There's not much to that.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
Where'd you live?
I lived all over the place. I probably lived in 7 or 8 different neighborhoods over the course of 6, 7, 8 years living there. So I was moving average about every year.
What was your first neighborhood that you lived in?
First neighborhood was the Sunset. I lived
'cause
two
we do have a lot of San Francisco guys listening. So I want.
Oh yeah.
And I always talk a little bit of shit.
Well,
which I don't. So. I always talk a little bit because the San Francisco people come here. And they like to say, like, I love New York, but I'd never want to live here kind of thing. And I go to their city, and I'm very nice and gracious, and yeah. I enjoy myself, and I genuinely enjoy it.
Yeah.
But they seem to be, like, totally okay coming here and poo-pooing.
Well, you know, I think, yeah, people always like the trash talk, you know, people on the other side, but...
Especially us.
I mean...
We're Darth Vader.
Yeah, yeah. I can say... things that I like and dislike about both places. I still love going back to the Bay Area, and I'm also glad I live here now, and so, I don't know.
Did you ever live in the Mission, man?
Yeah, I lived in the Mission for, gosh, what, 3, 4 years? Was the last place I lived in San Francisco was in the Mission. And I had a lovely little room that was about, you know, this exactly the size of my bed that was and an office space for $500 a month, and so that is something that I think is virtually impossible to find these days. So
I know, man. I know. Actually, I'm moving out of this place. We're doing a little split so for a while, and I'm moving up to Greenpoint. And I found something for $780, and the guy's great. Just some Irish guy, and he's just like, just you know. I was like, so you need like first last month? Is this a broker fee or whatever? No, just come on in. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
So that's the last time that's going to happen. As soon as that guy, you know,
yeah.
moves on, I think that's it.
There are a few left in the city, these
but it's just
old school landlords.
You don't know what you're going to... They're just people. They're not trying to make millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what my first landlord in New York City, when I, you know, I couldn't believe that he was willing to rent to me without, you know, this big, long application process and needing all these credit checks and everything.
The last guy wanted a picture of us together. So we sent him our, like, you know, 15th anniversary picture of us just, like, posing. Like, whoa, dude. It was insane.
It's a little bizarre.
It's pretty bizarre. It gets pretty nuts. Like, give me a headshot?
Yeah.
Are you serious? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And the financials they wanted just completely... I mean, it's embarrassing. I don't like that he knows how impoverished I am.
He wants to see your stock portfolio before he signs the lease.
I don't have a stock portfolio. Do you have a stock portfolio?
No.
Okay. So anyway, as far as living in San Francisco, I mean, I never lived there, but I always like loved it. I do love it. I do love it. I just don't like people talking shit on my city. But I do like San Francisco. What about Sacramento?
No as far as what? Well, no, that was the closest airport to where I grew up. So I mean, that was the big
city. Do you still fly back to Sacramento?
Sometimes. Yeah, it depends on what I'm doing. But yeah, if I'm going straight home to visit, you know, home, I'm going to go into Sacramento. But I also have tons of family. Most of my friends are in the Bay Area in terms of California friends. So
what about your mom? What does your mom do?
My mom was a school teacher. So she, from teaching in San Francisco to New York also where my parents settled in the foothills, she was a teacher there.
Like elementary school?
Elementary school, yeah. Yeah. So.
You getting a call?
I gotta take this. No.
I gotta take this. No, it's cool. The last guy had to take it because it was his mom calling.
Did you put the speakerphone on? And
I was like, you can
put
take
it on the
it,
podcast.
We have to listen.
Air it. Comrade, 45-minute conversation with his mom.
That looked like a number.
It was probably a, you know, telemarketer.
Right. Oh, yeah. Those guys are starting to drive me fucking nuts. They started calling me because they think because you have a website that has your name on it, they think that you are a business owner.
Yeah.
So you're getting those where they're like, we got a small business loan for you.
Yeah.
I don't know. They call me like 3 times a day now.
Just take the loan and never pay it back, you know.
I'll take it.
Give it to them where it counts.
Right. And then, so what do you think was the, I mean, you know, we all know, well, not we all know, but there is, I mean, there seems to be a difference in temperament, I'd imagine, between Dušan and David Tannenbaum over there. But you studied with both of them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a rare thing for people to move from teacher to teacher at the same conservatory. Was that a struggle for you, or was that how'd that decision go down? You started out with Tannenbaum.
Yeah. Well, after 4 years, and I had actually taken private lessons with David for, about once every 3 months for a couple of years before I started at the conservatory. So I had already several years.
So you finished your bachelor's with David, and then you did a master's there as well. Okay,
yeah,
so you did the whole thing there.
Yeah,
oh, that makes sense. That's not a big deal.
It wasn't like I changed mid-semester or something. Some people did that, but it was a little bit awkward.
That you're a composer.
Yeah.
And so you wanted to learn how to compose too.
And what oddly enough, a lot of people don't know about Dušan is that he's an incredibly gifted improviser. And
yes, I've heard that actually.
So, and he was even teaching some improvisation classes then, but so I first took his improvisation class and then realized, wow, you know, this guy has an incredible amount to learn. So
what were you doing the improvisation for? Were you just thinking like, I want to improvise? I mean, you probably improvised. I improvised.
Yeah.
Noodling.
I mean, yeah, just noodling around and stuff. And then, but taking his class, I realized that there was a lot more to it than that, and so part of my actual lessons with him, he would give me these like 2 or 3 hour lessons in his house, and we would spend the first hour at least just improvising together, and then you know, I would show him a piece that I was working on writing, and then he would give me some ideas about that, and then we would say, oh, I guess we should probably like look at the Rodrigo Concerto for a few minutes, you know, because it's part of the curriculum, you know. It's like, but the focus was actually really on improvisation and composition, so, which was great because I hadn't had that previously. And it was really,
now, when you guys improvised, were you improvising on a classic? On classical guitar, like a nylon string?
Yeah.
You were? And I mean, that's a rarity.
Yeah.
That's a rarity.
Well, it is in the sense that we were doing it, which is to say that we were, you know, he was trying to get me to think about counterpoint and improvisation and not just, you know, like a sort of simple melodic, you know, riffs on a guitar, like, which is what most people do as kind of an MO, you know, for improvisation.
Right.
He was trying to get me to think outside the box and more like a way that a pianist would improvise. Basically, we were approaching it. His whole thing is approaching it from, like, historically. You know, that's how he taught his classes, starting with species counterpoint, you know, Fuchs from Fuchs, and going through, like, the history of improvisation in a classical construct, and that was something that I had never even thought about.
That's
previously.
Amazing.
It just really.
So he's talking about figured bass, even stuff like that.
We moved through that everything up until I think we kind of stopped with like essentially with jazz. You know, was kind of where we ended up, and we didn't because everybody had some experience with rock improvisation anyway. So
right,
and as you know, classical guitarists, we didn't really need to go there. So,
well, as far as the, I'm sure people are wondering about the, you know, it obviously wasn't a curriculum. It was just sitting down and improvising.
Yeah.
But like, what would you, I mean, I don't even know what you would start with. So would you start with something like kind of like improvise in like you're saying, like maybe like a Renaissance style or something like that?
Yeah. That was a lot of what we would do. You know, I would, one of the things is when I was learning some of
that.
It
must have been
a
ball, man. You guys just must have made each other laugh and had so much
great.
Fun.
It was super fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if I was learning a Dom Milano fantasy or something, we would look at ways that you could, because those are
variations
fairly,
on the theme. Or
yeah, they, or some of it, like a lot of those fantasias are like, they're like early fugues, essentially. They're incredibly complex, all the polyphony and everything. So trying to think about how to create that on the spot is really daunting for a, you know, like 20-year-old kid or whatever. Like, how do I even go about that? But really the reason why it's daunting for most people, for pretty much anyone, is that you haven't tried it before.
Yeah.
So if you spend like an hour a day doing it, then you realize, oh, this is actually, it's not impossible. It's just really hard.
It's just harder than noodling or reading a notes off a page.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But as far as the physical, you know, the ability and stuff like that, like you said, you were doing maybe Rodrigo one, you know, for a competition or something like that. Did you kind of get into that stuff? Did you how'd you do with the box suites and stuff like that?
Oh,
did
great.
You try to run from those as fast as you could?
No, I was still really into that stuff at that point. I was still, you know, playing the box suites and all, you know, a lot of the repertoire, but I think as I got older, there were fewer and fewer composers / compositions that I wanted to spend my time learning. Because, you know, it actually, the harder the repertoire gets, the more time it takes to learn it, and the more hours you have to spend in the practice room. And I wanted to kind of spend more time, increasingly more time on writing my own music.
Yeah.
And
well, that's when you start really doing it, because I did that too. And it was like, and it just gets to a point where you're like, why would I learn another thing? Once you start writing, it's hard to justify spending that much time learning an entire box suite.
Yeah.
Because you're like, well, I've got something to say now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It actually kind of doesn't feel right. It feels like you're cheating the medium.
Well, for me,
Not for everybody, for people that just do that, that's great.
Yeah.
I enjoy it too, but it's almost like an exercise in enjoyment. And then I also don't like the concerts that much where someone just sort of like learned a box suite on the side and they like read it.
Yeah.
You know? They're reading it on stage instead of having it memorized or something like that.
Yeah, unless it's like one of the...
I like a commitment on either side.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it's, for me, it's just something that I do for my own pleasure. It's not...
Exactly, you know, right. It's not something to showcase.
I don't feel compelled to perform that stuff anymore. There are plenty of people doing that.
Yeah, there are. And that's the other point. But at that point, I mean, you had already... So you had not decided once you started your master's that you were going to be a composer, you were just sort of just moving on to Duchamp and working on improvisation?
Right.
As far as improvisation informing you as a composer, I mean, is that basically what you're doing? Are you composing at the guitar most of the time?
You mean now?
Yeah.
I would say kind of half and half. If I'm writing something for the guitar, often that would start by improvising on the guitar, but not necessarily all the time. Sometimes the best things kind of pop into your head when you're like on the subway train or, you know, it's about half of the time when I'm not.
Yeah. The melodies are on the train, but the textures are at the
inspiration coming from the, you know, the chugga chugga and all the mechanical sounds and the screeches and the, you know, the people like arguing in the seat next to you and
right. And the dancers.
And the dancers.
Yeah. I don't like the dancers. I hate saying it. It's like I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of having it. That's a meditative experience.
The boombox dancers?
Just anybody. I just don't like being bothered on the subway. Like I and as I'm getting older, it's becoming I'm passionately angry about it. Like, I'm like, please, like, because it's so enjoyable. Subway could be such an enjoyable experience if it was just a quiet time for you just to sit there and do nothing but just sort of zone out and, like, focus on the sounds. I mean, it's like, otherworldly when that happens. Right. And then some guy comes, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry for the interruption.
Start playing like really obnoxious guitar music next time they do that.
And with my little Yamaha teaching guitar.
Yeah, I'm
gonna make a point. Next time you do that, I'll interrupt you. But and I know it's insensitive, and I'm being a butt about it. But it just could be such a nicer experience than it is. But anyway, so you back then when you did the Duchamp thing. He's not there anymore, right? He's in Brussels or something.
He's in Geneva now.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
As far as I know.
God, people just moving all over the place.
That's right.
You know, after that, after you learned the improvisation, did you start composing with him or did you...
He wasn't technically a composition teacher at that point. So we weren't technically allowed to do that as part of the curriculum.
Really? So, that's what I was going to ask, because that's the thing, is I can imagine that there would be pressure on him not to do these things.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
he should be entering competition.
Well, yeah, and we did, you know, like the lessons were like two or three times longer than he was, you know, required to give. So basically, if we got roughly an hour in on repertoire, we could do whatever we wanted. So that was great. So that's
how long were his lessons?
Well, sometimes I'd be there for like over two hours, 3 hours even sometimes. And that was just because, he's an incredible, he's really, he's a guru is what he was to me. You know, he really like if you had something you genuinely wanted to learn, he was like the best teacher for it. His knowledge ran really, really deep, still does, you know. I when he left, when he went to Geneva, hoping that he would stay longer just so I could get some more time with him. But
right.
Now it's a long commute.
It's pretty far to Geneva.
Yeah.
It's pretty far. And I don't know if you go there a lot with your group and everything like that. But as far as going after that, where'd you go? Where'd you float around then? That was a long time ago then. I mean, I'm assuming you got your master's at least 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. Yeah. I taught for a year at Humboldt State University.
Really? Yep. Were you the guitar professor
there? I was for
what
a year.
What year was that? Let me know.
05, 06.
Okay, 05, 06. My brother went to Humboldt.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really nice up there.
He studied journalism, so you wouldn't have run into him.
Yeah.
How was that, dude? Great?
It was great, but
are you a weed guy? Do you smoke a little bit of weed?
I'm not a weed guy. No, no I'm a terrible stoner.
I clam up. I can't function. So no weed, kids.
Yeah. But what was I going to say? What was interesting about that, living up there, even though it was super beautiful and I enjoyed it, mm-hmm. It was incredibly impractical because I was at that point doing a fair amount of touring, you know, despite having a teaching job, and it was 6 hours from San Francisco.
Right.
So it 12 hours of driving or a $500 plane ticket just to get back and forth to San Francisco.
Right.
So it didn't make sense after being there like 9 months. I took off. I just took off. So, but it was fun. I enjoyed it for a year. It was a really nice place to live.
It was
beautiful. Beautiful
place. I mean, absolutely beautiful. Yeah. One of the most beautiful places on earth. It's a rainforest.
Yeah. Redwood Forest, yeah.
Yeah, I know it's a redwood forest. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it's gorgeous.
I know. I never visited my brother up there. I mean, again, it's just too far. I was like, I'm here. You know, I travel. Yeah. I've always lived far. I went to Texas.
Yeah.
So I always had to come back from either Austin or here.
Yeah.
And it was just like the last thing I wanted to do was get in a car for 6 hours and drive north.
I know.
Man, it's the best. I always went up to Oregon. I went to Ashland and stuff that. Yeah, I loved all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, the North Coast is incredible.
It's really, really, it's magical.
It is.
It is. So you go through there, you come back to San Francisco, and you're like, all right, I'm back in San Francisco. You start a group? You said you started touring as a soloist, or what were you doing?
A little bit, but I was mostly, let's see, at that point, I was playing in a few groups. One was a group with Dushan called the Faya Guitar Trio.
Oh, so he just picked you up right out. He's like, I'm taking this kid with me.
He picked me up when I was still studying with him, and I started playing in that group. And we were doing, you know, a handful
of... Faya Trio.
Faya Guitar Trio, yeah.
I've heard of them and you.
It was
a really fun
group.
Who else was in it?
Kenton Youngstrom, who was still one of my very good friends and incredible.
Your
incredible
age?
Guitarist.
Our age?
He's a little older than I am.
Okay.
But so there was that group. I was playing in a group called the World Guitar Ensemble, which was, I think, around 9 guitar players and based in Europe. And we were doing a lot of Europe touring. Then I was playing in a group called the Modern Mandolin Quartet for, 3-4 years?
You played mandolin?
I played mandocello in that group, yeah.
What's a big mandolin? Is that what that means?
Big mandolin.
How big?
Tune like a cello. Yay. Big.
Like big?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's a gorgeous instrument.
Why have I never seen this thing?
I don't know. You should check it out.
I should check it out.
Yeah.
Mandocello.
Mandocello.
Yeah. I'm into it. But it's a mandolin. Is it made by Gibson?
There are a lot of different makers. That Gibson has, you know, of course, beautiful.
So you were the bass.
I was the bass player. Yeah,
bass player
or cello player more. It's a the quartet was a string quartet, but
it's this big. Is it sit like a
strings.
Cello?
No,
no.
It's like you play it like a mandolin.
Like a mandolin.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love mandolin, dude.
It's great. It's a really hard instrument to play because
it's so close together.
Well,
so
the string tension's really high and the strings are double strung like a mandolin, you know. So playing things like we were playing Bach Brandenburg Concerti and stuff, which was super hard on the left hand for me. So
because I know that because I played some mandolin. I learned a little bit like in high school just for fun. But like is the neck really small like that? with the mandocello? It's about the size of a normal steel string.
It's like
I'd imagine.
Let's see. It probably depends on the instrument, with the neck shape, of course. But yeah. It was, you know, it's like a mandolin. I think mine was a V neck, so it was a thinner, but had that V in the back, so it was kind of thick in the middle of the back of the neck, and it, you know, it wasn't like as thick as a classical guitar neck.
Right. It's teeny, little stick.
Yeah.
How many instruments do you know how to play? Like note reading?
Not really many. I mean,
so mandolin was to actually read enough to be able to read a Brandenburg concerto on it must have been a pain.
Well, and it was all in bass clef too, so that was...
Whoa, come on now. What are you doing that to yourself? Are you serious?
Well, it was crazy because when they called me...
You're like, I'm going to compose, improvise. You know what? I'm going to play a mandolin. You know, now I'm going to play a big mandolin.
Well, it was one of those things where, you know, you just say yes when you get the call. And,
right.
And they're like, we have all these gigs lined up. Can you do them? Or can you audition?
And it sounded interesting enough to do.
Yeah,
so right.
Of course I want to do that. And they're like, can you come tomorrow and audition? Here's the music. And I've never even played one of these things, you know? And so I spent the whole day figuring it out and
they couldn't find anybody else who would be able to read mandolin music.
It's a funny skill because most mandolin players don't come from a bluegrass tradition.
Music.
So they either don't read music or don't understand, or they might read music, but they don't
phrase
have the same, sort of knowledge of classical music or the same approach to classical music.
Sure.
So I think they really wanted someone who had classical music experience, and I don't know. I didn't have bluegrass experience. Still don't, you know.
No, those guys are beasts. And every time I see them, I think, boy, we think we're fast. Those guys are way fast. I don't know how fast. Like a bluegrass guitarist is unreal.
Yeah,
especially a young gun, like a young Nashville guy, like a studio guy. I've seen one of those guys the other day. It was just insane. It's insane.
Yeah. There are some great, great ones in New York City. I mean,
is that what the thing is with you? Was that the attraction of the mandolin in the first place? Like Ricky Skaggs, stuff like that?
No. I mean, I didn't really think about the mandolin at all until I got this call about joining that group. So I came to it through classical music, which
in Northern California, Dave Grisman was always popping up and playing everywhere. I used to go see him in high school. I love mandolin.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the best. You go to that Dave Grisman quintet?
I've never seen him live, but
he's another one of us. He's another Northern California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Marin County guy.
Uh-huh.
Dude, so then you moved. I mean, this is kind of mind-blowing that at this point you're in New York now. I mean, this is like you are kind of in the woods a lot, and then you kind of go into the, you know, the port town of San Francisco, and then you go back into the woods and come back to the port town. Where'd you go? I mean, how did you leave California? How old were you when you left California?
I only left California a little over five years ago, 5.5 years ago.
To move here. Directly to New York.
Mm-hmm.
What attracted you to the Big Apple here?
Well, I mean,
it's fun as shit.
What's not to love? Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, 5 years ago, so 5 years ago for you, would have been 33.
Yeah.
So 33, all of a sudden, you're just like, I'm going to go give New York a shot.
Yeah, you know, I was already playing here a fair amount, maybe like twice a year, two, three times a year. And every time I came here, I was amazed by how much activity there was going on and kind of unusual circles and you know, I could do things here that I couldn't do to the same degree in the Bay Area. And every time I'd come here, I'd make connections and meet people that were doing really interesting things artistically, and things just seemed to be happening. And then I would go home and find myself missing that energy that I experienced in New York City. So after getting over my kind of ridiculous trepidation about living in a city this big, I just said, okay, I'm not going to have a better, more opportune time to do it than right then. So.
When you met the people, do you meet them through just playing with them?
Or mostly just if there was a concert that featured lots of musicians, just talking to people backstage, green room conversations with other people who had lived in New York City, and just, you know, talking about their experiences and, oh, I work with this label, you should talk to them. You know,
oh, wow.
Just, you know, things sort of everything from just friendly conversations to networking to whatever. It just seemed to be happening here on another level, you know. And I wanted more of that. And,
right.
And then I started getting calls. You know, if I was in New York for a week and then I went back to California, sometimes people would call me and say, "Hey, I've got this gig next week in New York. Can you do it?" And I said, "Well, no, I actually don't live there.
I'm back here. I've got a beginner guitar student I'm about to start teaching."
Yeah. Well, yeah. That was my reality. So. So I decided, well, if I'm there, I can actually take those calls and do those gigs, and I want to do that. So,
oh, that's so sweet. All right, so that's kind of, and when they're asking you to do these gigs, is that what it is? Improvisation, classical improvisation, or new music?
Well, it was all across the board, and it still is. I mean, I'm not really performing classical music anymore.
I'd imagine. But as far as the pickup gigs in New York, like, is it projects?
All kinds of stuff, you know, whether it's like, you know, I got called a couple weeks ago to accompany a singer, you know, on pretty short notice and doing, you know, Mexican songs. And it was really fantastic. It was super fun. And, you know, they wanted a flamenco guitarist. And I said, yeah, sure. Of course I'll do it. But I'm not a flamenco guitarist.
I know two different Rosciato patterns, yeah. And I will do them over and over again. Yeah. But as far as the group, I mean, you said you are in residence at Stone. Now, I don't know what Stone is. What's Stone?
Oh, the Stone is a venue in Lower East Side, run by the composer John Zorn.
It's John Zorn's place.
Yes.
Okay. Great.
So I've been involved now, I think, with three residencies there. They're week-long residencies, and the format changes from year to year. This last week was with a group I'm playing in called Dither, which is an electric guitar quartet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't responsible for all of the curation decisions, but I had, you know, I played a solo concert. I played probably like five programs with them. So it's a lot of work when it happens because... the way it currently is that you have 12 different sets over the course of 6 days. So it's a lot of work. We're talking 12 hours of music.
When you have a solo concert, what do you do? Do you play your pieces?
Yeah. The one I had Thursday, I wrote a bunch of new music for it. So I played only my own compositions and improvisations.
I mean, it's just okay. So you have that, and then you have Dither,
mm-hmm.
which is a scripted, you know, where you're reading scores, or are you improvising?
Well, both. Well, yeah, we play a lot of different kinds of music. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's always four guitars, usually electric. Although we have had opportunities to do acoustic things, which is super
like
fun.
Steel string acoustic, sure.
Yeah, all kinds of different instruments.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of, you know, a lot of loud, kind of edgy.
Well, that's the problem. That's what a residency is, and that probably turns a lot of guitarists off because it is just about producing a lot of music. Mm-hmm. And us, we have our set. I have a set of music for my quartet. I wrote it. It's there. But that's all I'm playing. I don't have anything else. So I think that's the thing. Is like a musician that's going to make a lot of money performing is probably going to have to be... Right. A really ballsy and just, I'll play a mandolin concerto, no problem. Yeah. I just say yes.
Sure.
Constantly just like taking on work that they probably really shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
But you do it, and then you also just, and improvisation is, now that I'm listening to you, that really is, and that's something we never talked about on here.
Oh, great.
In 70 episodes. So the idea of improvising in an actual way, in a professional way.
Right.
Not just as something you do for fun.
Right.
To the classical guitarist is a little foreign.
Yeah.
And yet it's been a way that you've been able to fill seats and to fill time, more importantly. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not talking about fluffing out time. I mean, you know how to improvise.
Right.
Because of Dushan.
Yeah.
And because of you.
Right.
So that's really interesting. I mean, how much, as far as a percentage, what would you say the percentage of those six sets is set aside for pure, I mean, not pure improvisation, but...
Yeah, I mean...
Like, how long is
it? For example, you know, this solo show that I had the other day, I played some pieces that were completely through composed, and I had some pieces that were completely improvised. Often what happens with me is that as part of the process of composition, a piece will be in a certain stage consisting of, you know, maybe like 3/4 composed and 1/4 improvised. And part of that is that it's just a work in progress. And the Stone, one of the great things about the environment at the Stone is it's kind of like this fertile sort of idea factory in a way. And I like using that when I've had residencies there, using that as a way to cultivate new ideas and explore other possibilities that I hadn't considered. And so on Thursday, for example, I had considered
just sitting in your apartment, you know,
yeah,
working a piece out or something. Now you actually have to like fill some space.
Yeah. At some point you have to play it for people, you know, and so, on Thursday there were certain pieces that weren't finished, but there was an idea that I had that was kind of like half baked. And so I would get to that point in the piece and it's like, oh, here's the part where I don't exactly know what I'm doing, but it's kind of the fun part, you know, because it's not like you get to that point in the piece and you say, okay, everybody, now I'm going to be improvising. Like it's fun to just, to not tell anyone when you're improvising or when you're playing something that's composed.
What's funny is I've had nightmares about having to improvise because I've forgotten part of my piece.
Yeah.
Where I just start playing a D chord. Yeah. I'm just like, oh shit.
Yeah.
But like, the idea of not having to have a piece completely 100% done.
Right.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's terrifying to a lot of people, but it's thrilling to me.
And you can even do that with, like you're saying, like you guys used to do it on, you know, De Milan and stuff like that. So you can even do that with a Renaissance or Baroque piece.
Sure.
And have some fun with it.
Sure.
And I remember doing that when I was 19.
Yeah.
Like when I was first learning all that stuff, I was like, I would take it and I'd start fiddling around with it.
Right.
There were two or three pieces that were like half pieces out of Frederick Node's book and half stuff that I made up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And now that's, you know, now it's like one or the other.
But yeah.
Like that kind of, John Zorn, how what's your relationship with him that made it, does that, like you're saying, it's such a fertile ground. Do you think that's because of him? Because he just does everything.
He
plays guitar, he plays saxophone, he composes.
He's an amazing producer. You know, label Sodic Records is releasing, you know, dozens of albums a year, and he's incredibly prolific as a composer and writing music that's very diverse. And yesterday afternoon playing at the Stone again. This is not part of Dither's residency, but John has a series of concerts there, which consist of bagatelles. He wrote 300 bagatelles last year.
Yeah.
And it's a huge body of work, and he's got, I don't know, a few dozen ensembles performing these pieces. And my project is with another guitarist named Julian Lage, who is an amazing, amazing player. And we have this two acoustic guitar duo project playing those pieces. And
Julian Lage.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He comes from a jazz background, cool. But is a, you know, total virtuoso. Yeah,
right. They all are. I mean, those guys are amazing.
Yeah. So that's just one, you know, one project of his. It's a rather new project, but so it's been really great to work with him. And he's a great producer in the sense that he comes to his artists with ideas and is really, really tactful about kind of nurturing these ideas and bringing them into fruition. And so that's been, you know, one of the huge, huge benefits of moving to New York is working with him and being involved in that whole, Sodic Records family
Yeah, that's massive. And that's what you mean when you talk about those are the biggest connections you've made.
Those are the kind of things that
I'm
talking about.
The idea of being able to have a home from which to create without paying tuition is a rarity in America right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They want you to pay the tuition and then you'll have a home and friends to play with.
Right.
But if you don't, it's hard to make your own way. And I would assume San Francisco probably would have something like that. I'm surprised they don't.
Well, there's a lot
maybe
happening there.
With John Zorn though.
There's
just not enough places to play.
He's an anomaly for sure.
New York's proximity to other large towns. That's what San Francisco doesn't have. What are you going to do? Where are you going to? Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Seattle?
Yeah.
Those are very far away.
Yeah.
Boston, Philadelphia, those are really close. D.C., those are close towns to here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, like, you know, large populations.
Another huge benefit to living here.
Well, the other thing is, like, well, what I'm able to do is play at these libraries mm-hmm. that have budgets for presenting.
Great.
And I don't know if those exist so much out there in California. When I look them up, there's not as many. Here, it's like they're all over the place.
Yeah.
They're Connecticut, Long Island, New Jersey. It's great.
Yeah.
You know? But it seems like there's a little bit more. There's just more people. More people, more mm-hmm. venues.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah. Geographically, it's way more convenient, I've found. You know?
Yeah. It's easier to get around.
Cities are pretty closely connected here.
And there's trains.
And there are trains, yeah.
Right. A lot of trains that aren't... We're not talking about Amtrak.
Right.
We're talking about essentially like... large light rail, yeah. commuter rail that extends the length yeah. of an entire state, you know,
right.
which is rare out there.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't
it's
exist.
Like, it's like as if BART went to Fresno.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, as far as the, as far as you play all three guitars. I noticed that with your album. By the way, I'm a huge fan of it. I mean, it's really, really great music.
Which album are you talking?
The one with the white cover. You know, your latest one, the one from last year.
White cover.
Is that the one with the black cover?
Oh, you mean, are you talking about...
Iva Bovita or whatever, something like that?
With Iva Bitova?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the Evian album.
That's not you?
Oh, yeah, it is. It is white, yeah. No, I have several... I have another record from last year that's also white, called Time to Feed. This is my group Probase.
Time to Feed, boy.
Yeah. So...
But as far as, I mean, it's just great. I mean, I hadn't really listened to it too much before we had scheduled the interview. But, because we were introduced through Frank Wallace.
That's right.
Put us together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
He's a sweetheart. He's a good guy.
Frank's great.
But as far as the everything that you're doing right now, I guess, is Dither your main, is that what you're working with? Are you working with them the most?
No. I mean, it's one of the things I'm spending a fair amount of time doing, you know, obviously my own solo, you know, composition, et cetera, that's still trying to get another solo album in the works right now. But, there's Dither, there's, the group Evian that you just mm-hmm. mentioned. And then I have this duo with, my good friend, Timba Harris, who is a violin player and he lives in France, but, we do a fair amount of Europe circuit touring, and you know, every year. More
and he
or less.
Arranges. He's on top of that for you, and then you're on top of these for him.
Yeah, well, I mean, we kind of pool our resources, but right. yeah, we work pretty regularly together, and that's a really fun project because we're close friends, and also it's great because it's fairly logistically practical, just because there are only two of us,
right.
And I mean, as you know, if you're talking about your quartet, it's really hard. The more people you get
horrible.
Involved, it's
horrible
juggling schedules. And then you have, flights and all the fees that are associated with that.
Oh, I had to pay. I mean, and the thing is that good guys in these quartets, people have come and gone, but it's like, when you're paying somebody and they call you up and they're like, they're kind of haggling because another guy wants to pay him $150 more. You're kind of like, why are we having this conversation?
Yeah.
Over $150. Like, is this really happening to me? And like just those things. And you have to be like, well, it's okay. Like, go ahead. I don't know. I don't like the idea of having to constantly manage four people.
Yeah.
I had a hard time. I was in a guitar duo for a while and it was hard.
Yeah.
Just with two of us. And four, right. It's just been like, I'm just kind of like holding these guys together as best I can. Like, we're just all hanging on by a string.
Yeah.
Because people go. They do other things.
Yeah.
That's why I always Dither would be real tough.
Yeah. Well, we're... Fortunately, we have...
Residency.
Someone managing our affairs for us now, which is really helpful. And, just...
Where are the places... I mean, other than the Stone, what are your favorite places, venues-wise, in New York City right now? Because you are... I mean, you got Spectrum would be... I don't know if you play there, but that's... I guess it's smaller than Stone.
I've only been at Spectrum once, but I've played several times at Le Poisson Rouge on Bleecker Street, and there's a really great new venue right down the street from us now in Williamsburg called
Sawdust.
National Sawdust. Yeah, it just opened in October. I did several days in a row their opening weekend there, and it's a really fantastic venue. Oh, you got to check it out. It's really amazing. And anyway, so that's a great new addition to the. There's a big buzz about it right now.
No, yeah, National Sawdust is going to be, because it's a beautiful spot too.
It's a beautiful
space. I've seen the spot. Yeah. I haven't seen anybody playing it. And but it's cool.
They're about to any day now. I
think, and you get spit out right. It's kind of like La Poisson Rouge, except it's cooler than Bleecker Street.
Smaller.
When you get spit out onto the street, there's more places to go that are probably more palatable.
Yeah, it's right in the heart of it, and they're, you know, it's also smaller. Definitely a more intimate space.
Kind of reminds me of like the Y downtown. You ever been to that venue?
Yeah.
It's about that size. Kind of the same feeling.
Very. Ornate and beautifully designed on the inside.
That's cool. Well, you know, it was great having you. Is there anything else that you'd like to kind of touch on before we call it quits? Are you shocked that we're quitting this? Do you want to talk a lot more?
Oh, no, I'm fine. It's been really nice. Enjoyed talking with you. I can't think of any. You know, I'm like, I don't have an album I should be plugging right now or anything like that. But
no, the album came out last year.
Yeah, well, I had a bunch of albums come out last year. So right now, I'm trying to think about future stuff, which is my next.
I know
solo
you just finished your residency, so right now you're just kind of like, well, you know, here I am.
Today was my first day to breathe, so it's like my brain hasn't quite adjusted to.
Well. Then you got a little walk in the snow. Where do you, if you don't mind me asking, where do you live?
I live down in Flatbush, Lefferts Gardens area.
So, really?
Yeah.
I love Flatbush. You don't live in one of the houses, do you?
Houses? No, I live in an apartment.
You know the houses?
The houses?
The houses.
You know, with the front yards and all that stuff?
Or? Where it looks like you are in a little town in central New Jersey.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, no, I don't.
My friend's wife, her mom, she grew up in one of those.
Okay.
And so they still have it. Okay. You know, her mom bought it for $75,000 in 1956, and then you know now this house is there, and it's just like it's another world.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
it's still in the city, so you can't light the fire pit up. You know what I mean? But then you walk around, and all of a sudden you're like in Crown Heights.
Yeah,
it looks like.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the part where you are. You got the what's it called, the bar chord.
Yeah. Are that's like that? Ditmas Park. I'm actually, so yeah, I think what you're talking about, those houses more like Ditmas and Kensington around there. But,
I'm right. So it's not Flatbush, or it's kind of Flatbush?
I guess, I don't know exactly where the boundary lines are, but that's really, Barcourt is down on Cortelyou.
How do you like living there? Cortelyou is a stop, But how do you like living down there?
I like it a lot. I mean, it's very far. I'm a block from the park. So
Oh, you're a block from?
I'm a block from Prospect Park, and I'm in Manhattan in like 20 minutes on the Q train. So it's actually not.
It's not that bad.
It's not that bad. No.
It's kind of far from here.
It's far from here because there's no north-south lines in Brooklyn, which is, unless, you know.
Yeah, the G train.
I took the G. It took me about an hour to get here.
Jesus, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
Well, I used to live on the Upper East Side, so that would have been a total pain in the ass.
Oh, yeah, that'd be worse. Yeah.
That'd be the horrible thing for you to do. So you going back there now?
Yep.
All right, dude.
Yeah. You guys, nice talking to you, Brett.
Nice talking to you, too.
Yeah.
Guillaume.
Yeah.
Right? Guillaume.
All right, let's have that celebratory bourbon.
We will. Absolutely. Thanks for joining me, man.
Okay, take care.
All right, guys, that does it for that. This is Guillaume Riley, right? He's performing from the album Mela's Mantra. This is the track, The Changes Stay the Same, Part 3. I'll see you next time with composer, Grammy Award-winning composer and librettist, Herschel Garfine. And that's the way you pronounce his name. Pronunciations, I'm not always going to get it right. If your name isn't Bob, and you don't have a Protestant last name, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I'm not trying to be culturally insensitive. I'm just culturally ignorant. So that's the way it goes. And that's just going to have to be the way. You know, I can't spell either. So let's face it. There's a lot of things I can't do right. The spelling is a real issue. We'll get to that next time. I'll see you guys next time. And thanks for joining me. I thought that was a terrific interview. He's a great guy. And it's good to be back. Bye.